Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
And at 3:32 p.m., we're getting you some breaking news. Security agencies have detained two terrorist suspects from Okhla locality of Delhi. They are believed to be from the Islamic State of Khorasan province module.
ISIS turning its attention to the Indian Ocean region in the wake of losses across Syria and Iraq. Now, that's what intelligence reports have warned.
Welcome to States of Anarchy. I'm your host, Hamsini Hariharan, and every fortnight I try to break down issues in global affairs and foreign policy with the help of a guest. Over the last 10 years, the Islamic State has risen and fallen. Call it Daesh, ISIS, or ISIL, the terrorist organization at its peak commanded large areas in Syria and Iraq. In the last few years, however, they've been slowly losing ground, and last year, with the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the group seems to be losing even more momentum. However, this vacuum has also led to the sprouting of the group in new areas, particularly in South Asia. The Easter Sunday attacks in Sri Lanka in 2019 show that the region is not immune from the influence of the Islamic State. So, how do we think about the IS in South Asia? Why have so few Indians joined the fight for the caliphate, despite the fact that India has one of the largest Muslim populations in the world? My guest for today has worked in the Islamic State extensively. Kabir Taneja is a fellow with the Strategic Studies Program at the Observer Research Foundation. He recently wrote a book called The ISIS Peril, the world's most feared terror group and its shadow on South Asia. Before we get into the conversation with Kabir, though, let's take a short break. Hi, Kabir. Welcome to States of Anarchy. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's dive straight into it. Yeah. Tell me about ISIS. Tell me about their rise in the Middle East. What were their main aims? What did they want to do? How did they go about achieving it?
Yeah. Well, that's a loaded question to begin with. But so around like 2014 is when the so-called Islamic State, formally, if you want to put it that way, came into being when ISIS took over Mosul in northern Iraq. And the leader, now deceased leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, went to the Al-Nuri Mosque, which is a very popular and historic place of Islam worship, and gave a speech there, sort of announcing the Khilafat, basically. Mm-hmm. So, and at, by that time, you know, Iraq was in quite chaos. Syrian civil war was in a fairly messy situation, as it is today. And there was massive political vacuum in every corner. Mm. So there was a Shia-Sunni divide. There was protests against the Assad regime. Assad was getting support from the Iranians and the Russians, which allowed him to stay in power and fight back. The Western forces were sort of involved, but also disengaged at the same time because they already had Afghanistan happening. They had a bad, you know, situation in Iraq for the past 10 years that they were dealing with. They really, really did not want to get into another conundrum in the Middle East. This was during the Obama administration. So there were a lot of factors that were playing out in 2014. But one thing that happened with the rise of the Islamic State, especially when it was formalized, if you may want to call it that, in 2014, is that both the states that were involved, whether that be the US, NATO, or Russia, Iran, and even smaller jihadist groups in Syria and Iraq, including those aligned by Al-Qaeda, found the Islamic State unpalatable, right? Mm. So there was a weird convergence of even the likes of the US and Al-Qaeda groups against the Islamic State. Mm. US fought alongside Russia in trying to get rid of Islamic State. On the ground, Iran was doing a lot of work. US was directly or indirectly, however you want to see it, supporting it in a very sort of narrow-minded approach in getting rid of this new threat. But even then, you know, we knew, at least a couple of us who were studying Islamic State at that time, that this was a very temporary situation. Mm. ISIS was coming off as a nucleus that everyone was, you know, going after. But ISIS is not the reason why the civil war, either Syria or in Iraq, started. Mm. ISIS just entered into it. Mm. So, of course, the history before that is also as colorful as the group itself. You know, Islamic State or ISIS came out of what was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Al-Qaeda leadership at that time in Iraq saw Osama bin Laden as not aggressive enough in trying to work towards the Muslim Ummah or getting the caliphate, as it says in the holy texts and so on and so forth. And they saw bin Laden as too fixated on the Americans and the Israelis. When Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the first leader, when he was operating, his name was Zarqawi, he wanted to get rid of the Hashemite kingdom in Jordan, because that's where he came from, and was very disengaged with the whole just attack Israeli or American targets. And that, after a point, made a lot of friction between him and the Al-Qaeda leadership. But what happened was, in the middle of all this, in the early 2000s, going up till 2012, in a speech at the United Nations, General Colin Powell, who was George Bush's deputy, handling a lot of these foreign policy issues, made a speech in the United Nations saying that Zarqawi is the greatest, or one of the greatest threats that we face in the Middle East. So one of the reasons to justify the Iraq war in 2003. And Zarqawi was no one. And suddenly he was elevated to something of a similar stature, if not the same as bin Laden. So he had the political capital suddenly to break away, get fighters behind him, get narratives behind him, and challenge what he saw was a lethargic Al-Qaeda. And that's where sort of this entire system of Islamic State came into being. He met Baghdadi in prison in Iraq, and then Baghdadi took it to the next level by very strategically moving around the Syrian civil war. They were very cunning. They were very planned. It wasn't just a bunch of thugs roaming around. And we could, you know, when they saw political vacuums in Iraq, specifically the Iraqi army was disbanded by the Americans, and a lot of Sunni generals in the army were suddenly jobless, basically. And the only thing they know is how to fight.
And there are lots of arms also.
Yeah, I mean, arms are everywhere in the Middle East. You can't step aside without stepping on one. And so these guys were well-trained army guys, and suddenly they saw themselves threatened as Sunnis, because the government in Baghdad was overwhelmingly sort of going towards the Shias, backed by Iran, of course. So that led to a lot of these people join Islamic State in the northern Iraq parts. So there was a lot of experience that came into being. So that a lot of what you saw, the expansion that ISIS did on the ground, I'm not talking globally yet, online, is because they actually managed to get a lot of experienced hands from the Iraqi army into ISIS ranks. And they knew how to manage a war, basically. So that's how it sort of just, that was the initial stages. And of course, the whole online propaganda, the marketing that they did so well, they knew how to get on the front pages of the New York Times and Washington Post. It wasn't, you know, by not design, it was all by design.
Yeah, I was thinking about how the Islamic State was sort of different from its predecessors or other groups in the region. And one was that they did capture a lot of territory at that point in time when they first began very quickly. And they were able to capture mind space, right? You've done a lot of work about their online presence. Could you briefly tell us about how that went about?
Yeah, so look, what they did was, you know, they managed to make their group as an international jihadist brand, right? Of course, Al-Qaeda, even at that time, we knew that Al-Qaeda is going to outlast Islamic State because they were much more entrenched into theology, and they were much more entrenched into hierarchies. They were much more, if you may call it, subtle in their existence, right? So they knew how to play the politics in the Middle East. They knew that they're conservative in their outreach after 9/11. So,
but ideologically, they have sort of the same aim?
Of course. They have the same aim.
There's just no establish difference. A caliphate.
Yeah. I mean, that's the larger aim of most jihadist groups, is to establish a caliphate. But Al-Qaeda was, of course, as I mentioned before, much more interested in targeting the U.S. in the Middle East and making sure the U.S. leaves the Middle East. So sort of caliphate came second or maybe a third kind of aims that they had. And but what the Islamic State did was, of course, when Al-Qaeda was coming up, internet wasn't a big thing, neither was social media. What the Islamic State successfully managed is to, they recognize the power of the internet as far as messaging goes. And once they had the caliphate, they wanted people to travel and, you know, make that their base. What they also did was, everyone who was supporting the Islamic State, whether on Twitter, on Facebook, or Telegram later on, after Twitter and Facebook went after them and these accounts, they equated the online supporters to those who were fighting actually on the ground. So in a hierarchical situation, or if you want, if you may call it a sort of militaresque structure of an organization, the guys or the girls sitting online saying, you know, this is excellent, or trying to have outreach to people on social media saying, you need to join us, we seem to have similar wavelengths, and you seem to be talking about the same things, this is how you can join, so on and so forth, were given the same sort of rank as a guy with an AK-47 on the ground fighting for the Khilafat. So that, you know, that equation that they offered, that you are as important as a general fighting on the ground, I think bolstered a lot of people and made sure that a lot of people took this extremely seriously. I mean, even the people who were on the ground or were responsible for, you know, recruiting online till a certain extent at least. And they, you know, used to tell people who are online or who are their recruits online that if you can't make the journey to the Islamic State, then your job is to stay there and recruit and spread the message, spread the brand, and so on and so forth. And they did this extremely well. They have documents saying, there's one very popular document called Media Jihadist, You Are a Mujahid Too. And that basically explains in about 8-10 pages in very succinct good English why you are as important as Baghdadi's deputy. Right, so that gave people a sense of pride or whatever.
And a stake in the game.
Yeah. And but not just a stake, quite a heavy stake in the game. Or at least it seemed so, if anything else. Even if you want to see it as a placebo, making people feel important, especially in places in Europe where, you know, integration of religions, cultures, societies is not that well established. So if you go to Germany, for example, the Turks who shifted there in the 50s and 60s still live in their sort of islands around cities, and it's not very mishmashed or integrated. Belgium was another thing. France was another example. And that is why we saw, you know, places like Belgium and France sending more number of foreign fighters to the Khilafat than, let's say, India or Bangladesh.
Okay.
Right. So that's a, despite the times we are living in right now, that's a weirdly important success story of how, despite the partition in South Asia, integration has been fairly okay, which has disallowed radicalization at a big scale. You know, as far as the online space goes, it's they did a very good job. They knew how to make sure that Rukmini Kalamaki writes on them on the front page of the New York Times. They made sure how to get on the front pages of The Guardian, all the Western press. They gave interviews, they gave access to them online. So you could, the Amak News Agency became this sort of go-to place for people to, you know, get news of what Islamic State is doing. And since there was no way to double-check this, that became the news, right? Whether it's true or not became very sort of, I think the press let that onus be on the audience, whether you want to believe Amak News or not. And I remember there was an Italian journalist who was captured by Islamic State and released, I think, a year ago or something. And he came out, and he, as a journalist, it was extremely scathing in an interview to BBC, saying that they've been playing the press just so damn well, and we've just been going on for the ride.
So what doesn't match up with what sort of the press has been reporting and maybe the actual situation on the ground?
No, I don't think there's, it's a question about what matches or doesn't match it. It's, you know, that you are taking, like, you know, as a journalist, if you talk to any journalist in Delhi or Bombay, if a PR agency comes to them and says, "My, this is a product, this is so good," your job is to not take it at face value. And you will, let's say a car review, you'll want to drive it, you'll still sit in it, you'll press the buttons, and then you'll come up with, okay, this is great or this is not great. I think that leverage in most cases was not available to the press, and they were very happy to sort of just go with the narrative that was being released by the Islamic State, which was quite damaging for a good 2 years.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is sort of that the images that were coming out of the Islamic State were very gory, and you had sort of like live-streamed beheadings and things like that.
You know what, that's a very good point. And I remember sitting with a friend of mine who works on artificial intelligence and just technology in general, trying to figure out how they managed to upload 4K quality videos to YouTube from a bombed out Aleppo. Like, where do you get that bandwidth? I don't get that bandwidth in Delhi, right? It takes me at least 1 hour to upload something.
The
like
studio
that.
Barely gets signal sometimes.
Right, right. So, but they managed to do it. So that clearly showed that they had, it wasn't just, you know, people sitting on phones. It was much more than that. Maybe they did buy technology or equipment from wherever, Turkey or whatever it was, which allowed them to build this capacity. And, you know, even in the areas that the Islamic State controlled, there were media drop-off points. So the local mujahids that were given responsibilities of, let's say, a 3 kilometer radius or a 5 kilometer radius, media propaganda was part of their deliverable. Like every 4 or 5 days, they were expected to bring a CD or a USB drive filled up with pictures or videos from what they have achieved in that 4 or 5 kilometer radius, whether it be against the population or against the regime of Assad or whatever it was. Send it back, drop off at that media point, which will get collated somewhere and probably be a part of a collage that is released, which we all have seen in that 14 to 16 period. We don't see all that much anymore, but during that period, they were very well produced videos. I don't want the audience to go and check these out. They're quite gory. But when the Islamic State captured that Jordanian F-16 pilot and burned him in a cage, that was a production that had at least that had drone shots and, you know, 3-4 angles and cameras. And it was a very Rambo-esque presentation, but a very real presentation. And, you know, these videos did work. They did reach a certain audience. They did reach people who may not necessarily be on the cusp of radicalization as far as religion goes. But they are interested in violence. They are interested in being a commander of a militia, or they are interested in creating discord. You know, those kind of characters also made their way through, including some people who were not even Muslims. You know, they were mercenaries and stuff.
Yeah, that's something that I've also wondered about. Is it fair to say that most of the people who were sort of, I don't even know if radicalized is the right term, but is most of the people who were listening to and sort of open to the stuff that the Islamic State was putting out there in the internet? Is it fair to say that most of them immigrants or most of them are Muslim, or did the Islamic State have a wider audience?
No, so most of them are Muslims, and even if the people who joined from non-Muslim backgrounds had to convert to Islam before they joined. So I think the religious police that, you know, patrolled these areas were very strict with that. You know, your pajamas or pants needed to be of a certain length, your beard needed to be of a certain length, which is required by the Sharia as per the Islamic State's requirements, so on and so forth. You know, you needed to be that. So it wasn't just a sort of, you know, a video game kind of situation. Theology always plays a very strong part in this, right? So if you see the Islamic State structure, if you see Baghdadi was made the caliph because he had a PhD in Islamic studies, right? He's a very well-read man. And he was, because he had studied so much Islam, both in madrasas and actual universities in Iraq, he was seen as, okay, he knows about this. So it's okay to follow him. And he has that stature to become the top ranked official for the Khilafat. And he was a good strategist, clearly. You know, he knew how to rally troops behind him. So it's, you know, religion is at the center of this. The interpretation of Islam is at the center of this. The Khilafat is an Islamic idea, right? But to strengthen that, they used, like any other militia, they used X, Y, Z, A, B, C, wherever it came from, specifically when it comes to money, whether that's extortion and, or initially when they took over land, they took over the refineries as well, and they actually ran them as companies. I remember them, Islamic State, during 14, 15, when they were having a free time on social media, releasing classified ads for people to run refineries. And they said, you know, and they were offering over $100,000 US a year. So even if someone was not an Islamic State person, but in that area stuck, they had to sort of work through with whatever was available to them. So, you know, it's both complicated and interesting at the same time with what they managed to do in such a short period of time. But the scale and speed at which they went with, I think most people knew the longevity is going to be very problematic, which we see now is.
Yeah, which is what gets me to it. There has been sort of a large recapturing of most of the territory under the Islamic State by the Kurdish forces, right? Yeah. So what does the Islamic State look like after the death of al-Baghdadi?
It's really difficult to say. I think the fact that Baghdadi was killed, so was his deputy, who would have been sort of the natural number two to take over the prime position. It's very difficult to assess. I mean, the Islamic State did announce a new person who's supposed to be the caliph, but we don't know who the person is, real name, coming from. They only released one statement. That could mean that they actually have someone and they're just waiting for a correct time. It's very messy right now. For this person to be elevated, or there's just infighting right now of who's going to be the chief there. So difficult to say. I mean, we also do know that there are thousands of fighters that are unaccounted for. And I'm pretty sure they haven't gone back to either the whatever the European countries they came from, or the Central Asian countries they came from, or the Iraqis, Syrians, Saudis, so on and so forth. They are all mostly unaccounted for. Now, for survivability, it's possible that they've joined smaller groups there. They've joined Al-Qaeda-aligned groups in northern Syria that are fighting with Turkey, for example. Or they have just, mixed into the refugees that are leaving. I remember when Islamic State initially made a threat that, all the refugees that you are taking in, we have sent our people there. I remember laughing it off. It turned out to be true till a certain extent. Now, whether that was by design or not, I'm not particularly sure. A lot of people basically went from being fighters of the Islamic State to back into society as people who have suffered against the Islamic State, just for a survivability kind of thing. But that's the thing. One thing that we knew from the start was, when everyone was converging on the Islamic State, that they will lose territory pretty quickly. It's one of the hardest things to do is to hold on territory, especially when you have, air capabilities. So you have the Russians bombing you, the Americans bombing you, and you have no sort of play against that. But it's, if they, Deir ez-Zor was a region in Syria where they conglomerated, they held the territory there. And I think that was the last one that they had. This was maybe a year and a half ago. But you know what? Even then, we knew that, okay, fine, they will lose the territory. But everyone who was fighting against them in unison, after ISIS is gone, they will turn on each other. Because that's what the original civil war was about. ISIS just came in and, stirred the pot. And once that happened, we saw the Kurdish, of course, fought hard against the Islamic State. But of course, the Kurds were fighting for something as well. They've been fighting for Kurdistan for a long time. And once they got that territory, they need resources to actually hold that territory, which we saw with the American withdrawal coming in, Russia playing a much bigger part as a country supporting Assad, which allowed Assad to push the Kurds a little more. And now the Kurds are in a situation where they are holding refugees, but they don't have resources. And they have openly stated that they will be forced to let go of thousands of Islamic State fighters if help doesn't come their way. And I don't see any help of that sort coming their way. So it's being played out in a very nascent stage at the moment. It can get very messy a year or two down the line, which is why a lot of articles that came saying ISIS 2.0 can be a thing. It was dismissed very easily by a lot of people. But I think they don't realize that it's not just about, Islamic State fighters with their sort of 4x4 pickup trucks roaming around right now. It's about that they are being held, but they will be let go. And most people will not be changing their ideologies anytime. So they will be let go with those ideologies. And they will try to come back in some shape or form. Maybe not ISIS, but something else. But equally bad or worse. So we'll have to wait and see in that aspect.
Yeah, and now with sort of the politics that's going on in the Middle East, you can also see ISIS perhaps focusing more on other areas, right? One of the areas that they've said more recently is South Asia, and that's what your new book is on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the presence of the Islamic State in South Asia? I know there are lots of different organizations, ISIS-K, there's ISIS-ISJK, there's Vilayat al-Hind.
Yeah, yeah.
How do all of these things configure?
Yeah, so again, this comes down to branding, I think.
Mm.
First and foremost, like, ISJK is not a thing.
Okay.
Right, ISJK, the sort of the term Islamic State, Jammu and Kashmir, was started or was used when a couple of people during stone pelting, you know, events in Kashmir a couple of years back came out with Islamic State flags, and that had IS sort of JK written on it. But, you know, it's very important for a country and a country's security services, police, so on and so forth, to understand how this works. Because we unfortunately came very close to legitimizing ISJK, an entity which did not exist. So we would have created it ourselves as a narrative for maybe just making it easier to bump militants off in Kashmir. Because once you say, oh, look, we have killed XYZ, who was an ISJK militant, no one's going to question you on it.
Yeah.
Right. Islamic State militant killed, no one is going to say, like, are you sure it was him? You know, show us identity and so on and so forth. That's not going to happen. And that started at some level in Kashmir. And I'm very glad it was stopped. Police commissioner being moved away from Kashmir at that time. But unless, you know, unless a group comes up, has a structure to it, offers official bayat to Islamic State, that is an official vow. That vow is accepted by the Islamic State chief. Till then, there is no official vilayat of Islamic State. ISK in Afghanistan has been operating since 2014, I think. This is the same year, basically. Their bayat was only accepted in 2019. In the early part of 2019. So a couple of months before Baghdadi was killed. Because Afghanistan, of course, is a very, you know, it's a country where there are more gray areas than black and white areas. So what does ISK even mean? You know, are they former TTP, sorry, Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan fighters? Are they former Afghan Taliban fighters? So on and so forth. So when the ISK came about, you know, people started questioning, okay, fine, who is this? Like, you can't just appear from nowhere. And a couple of studies that have come out since then have suggested, like, look, these are the people who were Pashtuns, driven away from the border areas between Afghanistan and Pakistan, when Pakistan had a campaign against militancy in that area. So when they crossed over to Afghanistan, they asked for refuge in Pashto villages on Afghanistan side. And the villages, seeing them as Pashtuns, gave them refuge for some time. But within those villages, then they started fomenting their ideologies. They started slowly, slowly taking over, started madrasas and so on and so forth, till the villages realized, okay, this is something that is not going our way. And a lot of these fighters ultimately became ISK. And so they were former Taliban. And why ISK is because at that point of time, in 2015 or 16, Islamic State or ISIS was something like Nike or Adidas. You wear a T-shirt and you have a branding. No one will ask you, right? They see the logo. They'll be like, right, I know this person. So in a country like Afghanistan, where there are warlords, there are hundreds of smaller groups, there are hundreds of smaller Islamist groups, the way to make yourself known immediately without doing the grunt work was to wear this tag. And I think they figured it, some people at least figured it out at that point of time. Afghanistan is still where the larger stronghold of Islamic State remains. As I mean, but if you move to South Asia in general, the largest Islamic State attack took place in Sri Lanka.
The Easter Sunday attacks.
Yeah, which is still a very bizarre happening. It's very difficult, or has been very difficult, to pinpoint whether Islamic State even knew these people, whether they were in touch with someone in Islamic State who was remote controlling the attacks, or were they just delinquents who decided to do it all by themselves. But there are a lot of gray areas, because the kind of explosives and weapons that they had, it was, the amount was quite high, which raised a lot of concerns and questions that how did they manage to, you know, build such an arsenal, considering they are not from very rich background or so on and so forth. And then, of course, the questions were raised, like, literally, like, how poor is the Sri Lankan security services to not realize this?
But this was also something that was happening through the 2015s and 16s, right? Is that if there was sort of like what they call a lone wolf attack somewhere, and then that person would have pledged himself to IS, the government was generally keen to underplay that and say, no, no, this is not the IS, because it would also reflect on their capability to deal with such an attack.
But, you know, historically, if you see European cases, the whole lone wolf concept mostly came from there, from those attacks, the knife attacks, a person taking a car, using it as a weapon. Now, it's very difficult for a state to stop those because you're not using traditional weaponry. You're not going out buying guns, which can be recorded as you purchasing a gun. You're not tapping into local criminal syndicates to buy black market guns and so on and so forth. You're using household items as weapons, which becomes very difficult to then check. But from what I understand and what I found in my research for the book, you know, there were a lot of attempts by the Islamic State of approaching single people to commit attacks in Europe. Now, these people were not interested in going out with 15, 20 people and creating mass sort of thing. But ISIS used this as a model which was very suitable to what the situation was in Europe. India was completely different, for example. In India, the cases that we went through of people not committing attacks, but showing radicalized tendencies of joining ISIS or being sympathetic to ISIS, were very, very non-committal on committing attacks by themselves. Right. So even, and first of all, they were non-committal in committing attacks in India, period. They were interested in committing the holy journey and going and living in the Khilafat. They were not interested in staying here. That was the crux of it. So once, you know, the air campaign against ISIS started, the Islamic State online presence started telling these people, look, doesn't seem a very conducive time for you to try and enter Syria or Iraq. Best thing to do for the group is commit attacks where you are. And once that happened, a lot of interest in at least the Indian cases subsided. They were not interested in macheting someone dead on the streets of Kolkata. Delhi, and they did recce missions. So, I mean, we have cases where, you know, Islamic State, again, I won't call them fighters yet, but sympathizers that were being targeted by Islamic State's online recruitment ecosystem and was actively in touch with them. You know, they did try to push these people into, you know, buying local weapons very similar to what happened in Europe and committing attacks locally. But in most cases, at least, there were two things that happened. First, the person, once realizing that due to various reasons, including paperwork, not having passports, you know, bureaucratic red lines, that they will not be able to actually travel to the Khilafat or live in Iraq or Syria, they just got disinterested and went back to their lives. So if they were a shop owner, they just were like, okay, fine, you know, I'm happy just looking at these videos or something, but I will not act on it, which is also a good thing. It's an unintended consequence of non-existent security policies of India, but on this issue at least. But there were also other cases where, you know, there was a fellow called Yusuf Al-Hindi who was a former Indian Mujahideen person, went to Afghanistan to fight, and from Afghanistan was trying to set up an ecosystem here in India of pro-ISIS, you know, people. And there were a fair few of them. Comparatively, not so many. But
so what do you mean comparatively, for example?
Like, let's say if France had 400 people who traveled to Syria or Iraq to fight with ISIS, India had 10. Something like that, right? But considering the population of Indian Muslims is 200 million plus, these cases did not exceed 150, which is nothing. And which is something actually that should be studied of why it didn't happen. So a lot of, so Yusuf Al-Hindi tried a lot to set up an ecosystem here. He even got 5-6 people talking together and forced them to meet in places, you know, gave a particular job. So the senior person got the title of Emir, who was supposed to handle all the other 5 people. There was an accountant who will work on the money that the Islamic State did plan to send in via various methods. So that it had reached till that level. But in a very Indian manner. I'm not sure how to put it, but within that group, you know, people were like, wait, why is he the emir and I'm not the emir? So why am I the count and why am I?
I was wondering what you were characterizing as Indian, yeah, but sure, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and there was a lot of internal fighting. And of course, this guy, Al-Hindi, which is a moniker, obviously, you know, was trying his level best to maintain some sort of accord with these people. So he had like these 3-4 groups, islands. So I think one was in South India somewhere, one in Northern India, trying to build an ecosystem. All of them failed, though, for various reasons. Internal bickering, people losing interest midway. In one case, there were two brothers who joined one of these groups, elder brother and younger brother. And of course, the younger brother, that's how it goes here. The elder brother radicalizes the younger brother. But the younger brother was not convinced with what was happening and basically went out and blurted out, this is what they're doing. And they were apprehended a couple of days later by the police. So one thing that, you know, a lot of these cases showed that the community did not really support what they were doing. So the community was usually the first ones to give them out to the cops or to whoever it was. Or at least force an intervention that what you are doing is just not good. It's not something we support, and so on and so forth. You know, how family structures are in South Asia, they are pretty strong.
Yeah.
As they are in the Middle East as well. But of course, this is quite different to both dynamics. But in some cases that we've actually written in the book, you can see how the family steps in and everyone just steps back. So it never actually goes to the cops or to the intelligences. It gets resolved within a community system. And which I thought was a very good example of when people ask why only 150 cases from India, second or third largest Muslim population in the world with 200 million plus, is because the communities are not radicalized, at least not on this.
So how would you say, like, sort of community structures or family structures are different, as you said, compared to the Middle East or even places in Southeast Asia like Indonesia, which have still seen a fair amount of ISIS sympathizers?
It's very difficult to point out. I mean, at least I couldn't do it with conviction.
Or what did you just sort of see here?
I think the two to three things, you know, like because most Muslim families in India are not on the top echelons of the middle class. They are very, for their kids at least, they're fairly pushy on the kids getting an education and a job and being part of the economic sort of uptake and so on and so forth. And they put in whatever resources they have behind their kids on these issues. So once they find the kid sort of getting off path, I think they step in fairly heavily, saying, look, we have spent XYZ on you. You will gain nothing out of this and get back to your studies and so on and so forth. And that's that. I think that's been at least a part of why more cases or more Islamic State cases didn't come out of India. But also there's been a historic shunning of this kind of radicalization in India. So if India has seen radicalization that is maybe stemming from the Kashmir issue or something that is much more regional than you know, a global Khilafat that everyone's interested in. That Khilafat idea or offer didn't go very far here. Because India in itself and this region in itself has a very rich history of Islamic studies. They have their own interpretations, they have their own cultures, they have their own ideas, which are much more Sufi based. Despite Sufism also having fair amount of radicalization within itself. But the kind of practice that has happened here over the past few centuries has at least till a large extent not made the likes of Al-Qaeda and ISIS be very popular groups here, right? So they're much more regional in their approach. They're not too bothered about what's happening in northern Iraq's village and so on and so forth. So I think somewhere over there.
So how is this sort of different from the Maldives, for example? Because even within South Asia, I think Maldives had about 200 odd people who went to
per capita, they had the highest.
Capita, they've
in the world, I think, not even
South Asia. Not even in South Asia, right? And so Maldives was 200 nationals out of 400,000 traveling to Syria, and on a per capita basis, the largest number. So why do we see that?
I think
that
Maldives
difference?
Is a very interesting case because they've been having a very slow But consistent, you know, dealings with Wahhabism as an ideology.
Mm.
So they are close to Saudi Arabia. A lot of Maldives people work in the Middle East.
Mm.
So they come back with similar, both money and ideologies.
Mm.
It's a small country, right? So even if a couple of people come back and start preaching and getting some success, you will see it from a, from a very magnified angle.
Mm.
And that is why, you know, Maldives is known as, mostly, for most cases from Maldives come as, oh, it's per capita, the most number of fighters. It's not that many people, but
if you see the
islands, population, it's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's just very interesting if you compare Maldives sort of the population or the culture of people going to the Middle East, Kerala, which also has very strong bonds with the Middle East. And there is a lot of remittance money coming from there.
Kerala did see a fair few cases, though, right? One of the first cases there of people actually getting out of India and joining Islamic State was from Kerala going to Afghanistan, joining ISK. A couple of them were actually killed, I think last year, in that mother of all bombs attack that the US did in northern Afghanistan. So, but there are also a lot of cases from Kerala where people had been stopped in their path to trying to join ISIS just by the community.
Mm.
And the police never came to know about it.
Mm.
Because especially in like northern Kerala, where Islam is very heavily based, it's a historic civilization there, right? That's where Islam is supposed to have landed in India.
Yeah.
And they have a rich history of themselves. It's just that the whole, you know, contact with the Middle East, renewed contact with the Middle East, specifically on religious lines and remittances. So money always plays a big part in these things.
Yeah.
Is about 50, 60 years old. That's when people migrating there were not just mere laborers. They actually started making something. And of course, you know, if you're living in countries like Saudi and UAE, and at least at that point, especially in the 80s, 90s, one of the, you know, outreach of Saudi as a state was that it exports Wahhabism as an ideology. But despite that, you can take that also, the fact that Kerala has a lot of in and out, going in and out. There are 8 million people working, Indian people working in the Middle East. Majority, I think, are from southern Indian states, and Kerala ranks quite high. Mm. Despite all that, 155 people, right? And that's the Home Ministry number. Our findings were near 180. But so it's you know, despite the sort of, I mean, if you see the historic linkages between the regions, the fact that we have lower number of people falling for that ideology than France, that's quite says something.
Yeah, and what I wonder right now with, for example, the targeted violence in Delhi against Muslims and sort of the state sanction of that, or the fact that Kashmir has been on lockdown for a very long time now, over 200 plus days, right? Do you think that's sort of maybe systemic framework where we say you have a community that steps in? Do you think what is happening now in India sort of threatens that fragile nature of... or illusion of peace that we have?
Most definitely. I think it certainly unnecessarily challenges it. It was always fragile. It wasn't hunky-dory ever.
Yeah, of course.
But it unnecessarily challenges it. And in this day and age where information, disinformation exists at scale, especially in a country like India, where even a person who can't read and write can operate a smartphone in a very basic manner, can play a video at least. That, you know, that offers huge challenges. In the past couple of days, while the Delhi riots were taking place, we saw a pro-Islamic State media outlet called Al-Qatil release a very India-specific magazine for the first time. And the cover was, Indian Muslims, where will you go from here? So, or something to those lines, I don't remember correctly, exactly. And, you know, anti-CA protest pictures on the cover and inside pictures of Modi, Amit Shah, Kanhaiya Kumar, and so on and so forth. And the, you know, they were not, the magazine did not attack one political class. They attacked everyone and basically asked the Muslims that, or basically told Indian Muslims, you're being pacifists for no reason. This is existential to you. You need to be much more aligned to what we think is a Khilafat or a Muslim Ummah, and you need to fight for it, and so on and so forth. So, you know, when these kind of events happen, they give space to these narratives. And these days, you never know what that one magazine leads to, or, you know, what that one magazine can do, that piece of propaganda can do. Of course, earlier propaganda, they were watching it from the battlefields of Syria and Iraq. But this is very Indian.
Yeah.
Right. How that, I mean, what kind of reaction that can have, I can't say. It's not, definitely not going to be a very positive one.
And because you spent a lot of time researching people who sympathized with the Islamic State, do you think sort of with the rise of Hindutva, more people would be at risk just because of a basic threatening rather than, you know, active violence is one thing.
Yeah.
But you also have sort of like the soft Hindutva that's on the rise,
yeah,
right?
I mean, again, it's difficult to quantify it. But in a couple of the chart sheets that we studied of ISIS sympathizers in India, they do mention groups like VHP and RSS by name. Because you have to understand, of course, the way the city dwellers see RSS and BJP, they see it as these sort of umbrella organizations. They have, what do you say, spokesperson on TV debates and so on and so forth. But these are also very granular organizations. They do work on very sort of, you know, village to village and lane to lane level. So even if you go to some of the slum dwellings in Delhi, you will see VHP dawakhanas or VHP medicine shops that subsidize medicines for these people. So, you know, it's not just about umbrella organizations. They're also working on a very, you know, basic level to increase the whole ideology that they support. And it is, I mean, I don't see in any capacity how this is going to be good in any shape or form. We have seen open calls calling it a clash of civilizations and, you know, a clash of ideologies and so on and so forth. I think after 2014, when the government came into play, we expected this at a certain level. I don't think anyone was moot about that. But, you know, it's on the contrary, you know, we can, I remember a former Indian diplomat telling me, I was just quizzing him that why can't I find any reactions by Saudi Arabia and the UAE? So Saudi is where the holy mosques are. So it's the most holiest places. On Godhra riots, for example. So they didn't have any specific bilateral calling for a stop or calling for India to restrain or fix their communal problems. The Organization of Islamic Countries, of course, did that, but not bilaterally. And he said, well, you know what, at some level, they know that this happens in India. So it's not out of the box for them. Yesterday, we saw Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif tweet that India should respect all religions and secure all populations and so on and so forth. I don't see that as, Iran actually being worried about what's happening in India. That's them trying to show down the Saudis that you're not doing anything.
Yeah.
And we are. So we are the rightful. We are more capable of protecting Muslims around the world. But Iran has never said anything about the Uyghurs in China, and neither has Saudi. So it's very intertwined with a lot of things. And it's... coming back to the base, the question that you put forward, it's going to have some sort of effect, specifically if this goes unchecked. Specifically if the narrative from the top leadership remains defiant on what's happening on the ground. That, we were provoked, or we also see a lot of narrative that, you know, Hindus are in trouble in India.
Yeah.
I personally don't see, I think it's created, right? But even if it is created, it's working for them.
Yeah, even when IS released that magazine just a couple of days ago, it was then picked up by a lot of people who believe in Hindutva, saying, see, this further cements our belief that this was in the works all along.
Absolutely. It was heavily shared on social media, mostly by the right wing crowd, and not so much by Muslims themselves, calling for action for Muslims to protect themselves. It was aimed at the Muslims, and they didn't buy too much into it. At least I didn't see it. But it was circulated mostly by the other side, by the right wing Hindu side, saying like, look, this is what now they are doing, that they will mobilize. You can see it. The Islamic State is releasing this stuff now, forgetting the fact that it's a pro-ISIS media outlet. We don't know who's running it. We don't know if it's sanctioned by the Islamic State. But the brand is just so powerful that you just say that, yeah, it is aligned to the Islamic State. ISIS is not going to say no. Right.
That's true.
Yeah, they're not going to say no. So you created that own sort of ecosystem. They'll be very happily, sort of put their stamp on it.
Mm. So when we're talking about the government, right, I remember maybe this was a couple of years ago, the Australian government, I think, released a counter-radicalization kit, I think called Jane the Terrorist or something. And it created like a lot of mirth online about like how poorly it was phrased. But what was sort of the government's role in this? We've talked a lot about sort of like the role of community and values in India at preventing people from going to join ISIS. But what about the role of the government?
So that's a very complicated thing to deal with because, you know, Indian security architecture on these issues is very heavily influenced by operations and the conflict in Kashmir. So when you're talking about counterterrorism, now there are different fields, right? There's counterterrorism, countering violent extremism, preventing violent extremism. Counterterrorism is basically leads to elimination of a terrorist. And that has been largely the big play of India and Kashmir. And I mean, you can't blame them. That's just how it is, considering the role of Pakistan in Kashmir. But that is a very hyper-local issue for us.
Mm.
We deal it as an internal issue, which as we should. But it relies on disputed boundaries and Pakistan's support for terror groups on the other side. I think we've never had a very concrete approach to dealing with transnational jihadist groups.
Mm.
Because earlier also, if you see the history of Al-Qaeda in Indian subcontinent, they never actually made it.
Mm.
They never made it big. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, with people like Awlaki running it, was actually a big thing in the Arabian Peninsula. So Yemen and beyond, they were fairly influential. And Awlaki's, you know, speeches and sermons were circulated globally everywhere. Mm. None of that characters were created for Al-Qaeda here. Mm. Al-Qaeda has been at it for a while.
Mm.
They've tried it in Kashmir. They've tried it using social media and trying to ape what the Islamic State did. But Kashmir is a very, you know, Kashmir issue.
Mm.
So when it comes to countering terrorism, all our security forces take experience from there.
Mm.
And that's problematic because that cannot be applied in every situation.
So we were talking about the government playing not so very important role in that sense because Kashmir is a hyper-local issue.
Yeah, so basically, you know, India's approach to terrorism or terror groups is very Kashmir-centric.
Mm.
So since we've been fighting there for 60 years. And a lot of people who, you know, do their postings in and out in the city sphere are at some point operational in Kashmir. So they internalize how to deal with terrorists as per the conflict in Kashmir.
Mm.
This is very different, right? This is where you can actually work pretty well with communities because there is very little community support to these groups. And even if you have the youth or a couple of youths, you know, falling off the wagon, so to speak, it is the best way to do it is via communities.
Mm.
But for that, you necessarily do not need a person experienced in Kashmir to handle it. Because their approach is very different, very direct and very counter-terrorism based, but not countering or preventing violent extremism based.
Mm.
So, you know, we've had cases in Northern Kerala, for example, where central agencies have basically just paradropped themselves, taken boys out for 3 days, and basically to scare them to not watch videos or whatever, or talk to Islamic State or propagate Islamic State online and so on and so forth. But there have been cases where families in that same locality have gone to the police and said, look, my son, I saw them watching this. You need to talk to them.
Mm.
And why they were able to do this is because the police in that local area is from that community itself in most cases.
Yeah.
So they don't feel, they don't think thrice or twice in approaching the cops because they are from that framework.
Yeah.
But if you have agencies or people being posted from other parts, especially those who have experienced counterterrorism policies and operations in Kashmir, they have a very different mind game to groups like Islamic State. And, you know, that's just not how it works because online radicalization is not necessarily someone committing an act.
Mm.
It's someone just mentally being bought into by an ideology that can turn into an act later on. And if it does turn into an act later on, then you apply your traditional methods on getting rid of a militant or a terrorist. But when you see it sort of, you know, a kid, 16, 17-year-old watching a Islamic State propaganda, your first line of defense is the parents, friends, so on and so forth. I've known cases where well-to-do people, educated people have, you know, confided in their friends, like, you know, this guy's making sense about the Islamic State and Khilafat, and, you know, that's where our comm should be. That's how it should be. And the friends have, like, literally said, if you're going to keep on doing this, we are going to tell your parents. And the guy stops. Right. It's just the family structure sort of comes into play that he doesn't want to confront his parents on this. So it's, you know, it's a whole different field of study. Which hasn't been internalized into our security thinking. Because a lot of people see it as not really effective. Or it's not, you know, it doesn't solve anything immediately. So it takes time. You'll have to, if you even see Indian de-radicalization programs in states, they're very half-baked, half... there's not enough effort behind it, but because these programs have seen some success in Britain or other places, and after the Islamic State peak and fall, the de-radicalization programs became sort of a fad in states. I think the center basically just told states to just try and build these up. At least it looks good, if anything else. But it's that differentiation on how to approach terrorism and how terrorism has evolved. In the past 5 years, how ISIS has forced it to evolve has not been internalized by our security yet. So, as you know, they say, especially on online radicalization, technology is always faster than policy.
Yeah, of course.
And most things in the security sphere are faster than Indian security policy. You know, it takes a lot of vision to recognize where radicalization, how radicalization happens now, or why even it happens now, especially after the Islamic State used the internet so well, and how to deal with it. I think it's something that India is fairly lacking behind at the moment.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me because I think like one of the worst things that you can do, one of the scariest things you can do in India is threaten to tell someone's parents about something, right? And that's something that you see on the streets. Or like if you,
you know,
see...
It may not sound that threatening in cities. In most cases, it is fairly threatening.
It is.
So the consequences can be, for the kid, can be quite significant. So, but that's what I was saying, because of those structures as well. It was recognized by Indian agencies as well that, you know, the community system is something that we should look into. But it's just not been internalized enough that this is a mechanism and there's no guarantee of success. You can only get into someone's head so much. I think it's worth trying at least, sincerely.
Fair enough. And, you know, with sort of the... Even though we say that ISIS has been defeated in the Middle East to an extent, we know that that's not true. As we spoke about earlier, you still have a lot of fighters who are unaccounted for. How do you think the Islamic State's presence in South Asia is going to look in the future? I know that we're not in the business of predicting, but what are the things that we should be watching out for?
Look, I think Sri Lanka was a very good example because it was a very celebrated narrative that, look, South Asia, barring the artisan bakery attack in Dhaka in 2016, barring that it's fairly unscathed. Afghanistan is again clubbed into South Asia, but it's a whole different dynamic that you cannot equate. And in India had seen sporadic cases here and there, but I think handled fairly well. We didn't see any major attacks. A couple of people caught in way while they were maybe trying to do something. But if you see the profiles of these people, they're not very bright. You need to have a certain level of, you know, brain space to conduct a terror attack as well. But there are a lot of these people were idealistic people who just bought into something and, you know, were trying their best to basically go and live in this place where they were promised guns and 72 virgins and women and everything that maybe they could not live out here in the real world was a weird sort of jihadist Disney world being offered. which they found very attractive. But it's I think Sri Lanka is a pinnacle example because we just don't understand it properly of what happened. There's very little clarity. Unfortunately, the Sri Lankan security forces have not released enough information of their investigations either on what exactly happened. It wasn't a small attack. There were a lot of people involved. There were a lot of intricacies of even local politics involved. But it's largely unresolved in my head. We don't know enough, and we should know more than what we know. And that is a threat, I think. That is the fact that these kind of scale attacks can go under the radar and take place. No one has done these kind of attacks for Al-Qaeda ever in this country or in this region at that scale. But Islamic State does manage to push people that scalability and, you know, sort of the scale is important in what you are trying to achieve as a terror group. And even if you see the history of the people who committed the attack in Sri Lanka, they had broken away from another organization based in Tamil Nadu and Sri Lanka. And they saw themselves, they saw that organization as not radical enough. Very similar to what Zarqa, why Zarqa we left Al-Qaeda. So these people had realized that whatever movement that they're part of, which is already radicalized by our definition, is not radical enough because we are not inflicting enough damage on the state or the people or the people of other religions and so on and so forth. So I think just that, the fact that it is possible to conduct these attacks without too much, without letting go of too much, but also the fact that in South Asia, the South Asian countries don't have mechanisms to share intelligence or discuss counterterrorism properly. So, I mean, India would very, I mean, they would share some intelligence with Bangladesh, maybe with Sri Lanka or something like that. But there's no official mechanism in South Asia which allows all countries to share data, because there is that, just that level of, you know, how do I put it?
Mistrust
in
each
mistrust.
Other.
Yeah, mistrust. There's that level of mistrust in each other. So it's a combination of the evolution of terrorism, of what ISIS has done, to the dysfunctions of our region in itself, especially when it comes to regional security. And I think that these are the main sort of takeaways. They'll have to pull up their socks, not just in India, but everywhere else, and see beyond their nitty-gritties, regional rivalries, which are always going to remain.
Yeah.
But on transnational groups such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda and all, no one here is in favor of them operating in this region. So that's at least a point of convergence that needs to be taken care of.
Fair enough. This is my last question for you, Kabir. What books or resources would you recommend for people who are interested in reading more about the Islamic State and South Asia and so on?
So, I mean, the thing, like, even writing this book was extremely difficult. And there are a lot of books around. But because a lot of these texts were written while Islamic State was rising, falling, attacking, and just breathing, it's never been easy to pinpoint. A lot of stuff that is in my book right now may have actually been now obsolete anyway. So it's difficult to say. I think, like, people like Brian Fishman has a good sort of historical account of where Islamic State came from. Charles Lister has a very good account of the sort of, you know, very hyper-local dynamics of the Syrian civil war, where Islamic State just plonked itself in. Fahad Gargis has a good book on, again, sort of the theological history that may have led to the rise of Islamic State. So that's a very different approach to it. It's not a CT or a political approach. It's more of a historical approach. I think a lot of good research papers have been done. So instead of books, because books are proper books of, you know, deep accounts are going to come out 5 years down the line.
Yeah, you can only do academic study after a phenomenon is over.
Well, even Al-Qaeda, we have some very good works on Al-Qaeda. But because Al-Qaeda has been there for a while now. But Islamic State 2014 officially, right? And there are multiple accounts, conflicting accounts and so on and so forth. But a lot of work, people like, you know, Charlie Winter has done a lot of work on the social media and media landscape of the Islamic State, which, and he's done some phenomenal work on it. So, I mean, along with books, some research papers, but mostly a lot of good research papers have come out in the past year. So that's a place to look at.
Okay. Thanks, Kabir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of States of Anarchy. Thanks for staying with us. If you want to read more about terrorism and the Islamic State, I've attached links to all the books that Kabir recommended along with his book. So do check those out. If the coronavirus is finally catching up to your doorstep, then you can use this time to listen to podcasts and brush up on your foreign policy. One way is to check out the Takshashila Institution's courses on public policy. They're mostly online and are of varying lengths depending on your interests. So go check them out as well. If you have any comments or questions, you can reach out to me at HamsniH on Twitter and at States of Anarchy on Instagram. You can listen to States of Anarchy not only on the IVM podcast app, but also on Spotify and iTunes, Castbox, Gaana, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. We'll be back on 31st March with a new episode.